From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. The Supreme Court and the problem of interpreting the American Constitution. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Edwin Yoder, Jr., a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. How should the Supreme Court best interpret the Constitution of the United States? As a living document responsive to contemporary social issues, or as a changeless cultural touchstone mined from the intentions of America's founders? Debate about that question and its legal and social implications finds expression in recent speeches by Attorney General Edwin Meese III and by Justice William Brennan, a member of the Supreme Court. According to William Luchtenberg and Edwin Yoder, both the Constitution itself and the political founders of this country offer little guidance about the role of the Supreme Court in its function as the nation's final arbiter of the Constitution. Moreover, the Supreme Court is an anomaly in a republican democracy, since it is unanswerable to the people or their elected representatives. Still, while the court can restrain or modify legislative action, it does not necessarily create public policy. Indeed, during its first 70 years, the Supreme Court declared acts of Congress unconstitutional only twice, in the cases of Marbury v. Madison and Dred Scott. Here is William Luchtenberg.
Well, there have always been contemporary legal scholars and political figures, policymakers, who have thought that all that one needed to do if one wanted to find out whether a statute was valid was simply hold it up against the Constitution and check it out. And there have been Supreme Court justices. Owen Roberts gave the classic statement of this in the Butler case in 1936, which is now referred to simply as mechanical jurisprudence, because a new generation of scholars finds it hard to believe that that one can do this. It was widely thought at the time that one ought to do no more than simply use the Constitution as a guide. But there are problems with attempting to do that. One is that it's not always clear whether the Constitution will provide for you, in a word like like commerce, or a phrase like due process, the kind of guide you need. Secondly, it's not clear whether you can discern what the intent of the framers was. And finally, not everybody would agree that if you could find out what the intent of the framers was, that the ideas of the 18th century ought to be the guides for people in the 20th century.
Well, let's address the question of the intentions of the founders, Bill Luchtenberg, Ed Yoder. Ed, maybe you can comment on this. Amongst the legal historians and people who do what you do, you write a syndicated column about politics and culture in the United States, either from a historical or a contemporary standpoint, are we supposed to look at the Constitution and say it has all the answers? How do we figure a way into a question like that?
Well, I suppose we have to go back to Chief Justice Marshall's dictum in one of his great decisions that the Constitution was intended to last for ages to come. It obviously then requires some flexibility in the interpretation. I don't myself feel particularly comfortable with either extreme in the current debate going on about original intention. That is to say, I don't really believe that the Constitution is or should be a piece of putty to be molded at the subjective whim of judges, nor on the other hand, I think it's crystal clear what these great phrases that Bill Luchtenberg has referred to mean, in particular reference to contemporary problems. I suppose the heart of the question is who decides, who makes these decisions? In our system, by long usage, the judges, the Constitution, as one of them said once upon a time, is what the judges say it is. Yeah. That doesn't mean that judges are at liberty to treat it as, as I say, as a piece of putty. On the other hand, it's also clear in our democratic tradition that the elected representatives of the people are ultimately the custodians of national sovereignty. And in the last analysis, judicial trends that go very much against the public will, setting aside those entrenched individual rights, which cannot be tampered with by a democratic process, setting those aside, the ultimate questions that arise are going to be political questions and are going to be decided in the last analysis by the representatives of the people.
Bill Luchtenberg?
Well, you have to remember that the Supreme Court has very little but appellate powers. That is to say, the Supreme Court can't go out and decide that it's going to do something in a field like abortion. Cases have to reach it.
Right. It's the buck stopping.
That's right. It's the buck stopping agency. And by the time the Supreme Court considers a matter like abortion, some other state agency has already acted. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about here is not a matter of setting policy generally on abortion, but what the states may do to limit the right of women to achieve abortion. That's the problem that the Supreme Court faced in Roe v. Wade. And in fairness to the court, it was a very difficult question. I don't think that there is any constitutional scholar who feels very comfortable about the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade. In the 1930s, the court went under attack because it was thought to be overreaching, putting its own views into the Constitution with respect to economic policy. And then in the 60s, with a decision with respect to birth control in Connecticut, with the availability of contraceptives, and then with Roe v. Wade in the 1970s, the court found it difficult to rationalize its own decision. To find any place in the Constitution that would authorize it to render the kind of decision that it did. And even people who think it made the right decision are worried about that. And yet it's not so easy to see what alternative course the court could have followed in Roe v. Wade that would have had a satisfactory result.
Ed Yoder.
I don't think it has much to do with one's view of the morality of abortion, frankly.
Or thinking for oneself.
At the time when Roe against Wade was decided, 1973, if I remember correctly, the trend within the states was the revision of, in most states, not all states, was the revision of abortion laws in the direction of a kind of moderate liberalization. That was not universally true. But it happened to be true, for example, in North Carolina and many other states. And here came the court, and Bill is quite right in saying that the court sometimes feels that it must tackle these things, that it really doesn't have an alternative. I said so in the case of Brown against Board of Education. But in Roe against Wade, it seemed to me the court reached into what constitutional lawyers call an unripe question, an unripened question, not really ripe for the supreme law-giving institution of the country to get into. Furthermore, it was unfortunate from the point of view of the way it was done. Justice Blackmun, who wrote the decision for the court majority, had been general counsel to the Mayo Clinic. Now, Justice Blackmun is an upright and able and conscientious jurist, but he tended to see this question, which had all sorts of prickly moral and legal ramifications, primarily as a case in medical, the state of medical technology. And he rested jurisprudentially, the decision rested on the so-called penumbra of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. But in reality, the way the decision was written, it was couched in terms of the state of medical technology, which exposed the decision to criticism based on the evolution, the inevitable evolution of that technology. Mm-hmm. This case came to the court out of a particularly egregious situation. A woman in Texas had been gang raped and had become pregnant as a result of a gang rape, And Texas law, which was, if I gather, absolutely prohibitory in allowing, even in those egregious circumstances, allowing a woman the option of abortion. And, you know, you would have had to have marble people, literally, not to respond sympathetically to a dilemma of this kind. I don't mean to minimize the dilemma, but there are many moral wrongs which may not be remediable or perhaps cannot be remedied on the instant without starting a lot of other hairs.
Mm-hmm. Bill, yes. Luchtenberg.
Yes, on what Edge just said, there's an interesting footnote to this case that sometime later, Blackman was approached by an unknown young woman who came up and kissed him. And he was completely flustered, and she said to him, "I just wanted to thank you." She said, "I'm Jane Roe."
Bill Luchtenberg from the University of North Carolina and Ed Yoder, syndicated columnist, were talking about American legal history, interpreting the Constitution. Up to this point in our discussion, you seem to be making the case for interpreting the Constitution on the basis, again, of local and temporal circumstances. What's the other side of the question? Who are the people, and what is the case for looking at the Constitution as changeless, etched in granite, providing cultural standards? I'm asking you to take the other side and tell me, you know, what the opposition might be saying. Ed Yoder?
Well, let's take something like cruel and unusual punishment, which are the famous words of the Eighth Amendment. There are many in our society today who would say that capital punishment is cruel and unusual punishment. Justice Brennan, in his recent lecture at Georgetown University, which in a way started the current dispute about the so-called original, well, it didn't really start it, but was a major contribution to the discussion of precisely the question you asked, said that in every capital case coming before the Supreme Court, he intended to vote to the effect, to use his discretion as a justice, to hold capital punishment unconstitutional as a cruel and unusual punishment. Now, the dilemma here is that it is well known that at the time when the Eighth Amendment was written, capital punishment existed in most, if not every, state of the Union, and a majority of the court have been most reluctant in recognition of that fact to move to strike down capital punishment. I dare say they have no particular appetite for it, as many of us do not in this day and time. But here is a case where the language of the Constitution has a specific historical reference. I don't see an answer in specific response to your question how that question can be answered without reference to particular historical circumstances. Mm-hmm. I dare say Bill, as a historian, would agree that there really isn't any other kind of reference point. Now the problem, as I see it, is that some judges believe that it is within their discretion to disregard these specific historical reference points, even when they are as clear as they are in the case of cruel and unusual punishment, and say, "Well, I have a moral duty to exercise mm-hmm. my discretion as a judge," notwithstanding these very hard, very definite, and certainly ascertainable historical circumstances and meanings of the words. That's where I have a real problem.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about the Supreme Court and interpreting the American Constitution. My guests are William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Edwin Yoder, Jr., a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, William Luchtenberg wrote In the Shadow of FDR, a history of the modern American presidency from Roosevelt to Reagan, published in 1983 by Cornell University Press. Professor Luchtenberg is now at work on two forthcoming books about FDR and the Supreme Court crisis of 1937. According to Edwin Yoder and William Luchtenberg, the Supreme Court is the least understood branch of American government. Is the court the guardian of citizens' natural rights or of a specific historical text? Should the Constitution be seen as a living document readable in the light of contemporary social issues or as a timeless cultural touchstone? Our topic is American Legal History, Interpreting the Constitution. Bill Luchtenberg from the University of North Carolina and Ed Yoder, syndicated columnist. Tell me about recent legal history. Tell me about changes, currents that have flowed and that you have observed between the Warren and the Berger courts. Is this a particularly special time that we live in with respect to interpreting the Constitution? Bill Luchtenberg?
We think today, if you ask people about what are the big changes, what are the most controversial questions about the Supreme Court of the past generation, I think they tend to think of abortion, busing, capital punishment, matters of that sort, and they associate them with the Warren Court. And the expectation was that when Earl Warren was succeeded by Nixon's appointee, who interestingly exactly reverses Earl Warren's name, he's Warren Earl Berger, that there would be a similar reversal of doctrine. The striking thing is that those decisions that we associate, many people do associate with the Warren Court, in fact, are decisions of the Berger Court.
Uh-huh.
Busing and abortion. Busing was a North Carolina case, the Swan Charlotte Mecklenburg case, Roe v. Wade on abortion, the capital punishment case of Furman against Georgia, the pornography case in California, that these seem to fit the mindset of the Warren Court, but they're actually all decisions of the Berger Court. And one of the things I think many people would not have anticipated is, on the one hand, a considerable amount of continuity between the changes that were developed for the first time in the Warren Court and the Berger Court, but also the breaking of new ground by the Berger Court. I think the main decisions that one associates with the Warren Court are in the field of race, starting with Brown, with respect to reapportionment, Baker against Carr and the other cases, and with respect to criminal justice, cases like Miranda and Escobedo. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been areas where the Berger Court has taken a step backwards, particularly with respect to criminal justice. But on the whole, I am more struck by how much continuity there is than by the discontinuity.
Ed Yoder, let me ask you to comment on that. Is the court ahistorical? Certainly it is not, and yet in a way it has to be. These people coming to the making of these decisions, since they don't take orders from anybody, they are setting their own, inventing themselves, as it were.
The question you've raised is an exceedingly interesting question. The historicity of judicial opinions. There is, I think, something certainly well known to Bill Luchtenberg and well known to most of us who take an interest in these things, which I would call lawyer's history or justice's history.
Bill Luchtenberg said that many attorneys do not have a strong sense of it.
Well, I think that's true. I quite agree with that.
Law professors.
I think lawyers tend to think like lawyers, as they've been trained to think, and I think they tend to use history in an instrumental way that historians like Bill Luchtenberg would regard as a slightly shady way to use history. I mean, I don't want to put words in Bill's mouth, but there are tendentious uses of history, and they make constant and regular appearances in judicial decisions. Let me give a specific example, again drawing from a justice already mentioned whom I greatly admire, Hugo Black. In Engle against Vitale, the famous, some would say infamous, I say sound decision of 1962, which in effect said that a state cannot impose a state-composed prayer in the public schoolroom, which incidentally was what specifically the court said. Justice Black went on to talk at great length about the history of religious repression or conformity in 17th century England under the famous Archbishop Laud, whose attempt to establish a kind of conformist regime of the Church of England was figured importantly in history of that time. I've read that decision. I've read what the justice had to say about the English history of the time. I think he gets it about, I would say, 45 degrees wrong, the history I'm talking about, but he uses it very skillfully to reinforce the point that he wants to make. I have heard friends and indeed former clerks of the late Justice Black say that when a First Amendment Establishment Clause came before the court, the first thing the justice asked for was Fox's Book of Martyrs, which was that famous Protestant tract which memorialized the people burned by the monarch known to us in English history as Bloody Mary, who came between her younger brother and the great Queen Elizabeth. So judges have a way of using history, some would say abusing history.
Bill Luchtenberg.
Well, I think the question you raise is one that's of considerable concern to historians, and for a particular reason. A few years ago, after the Nixon tapes case, Congress set up a national commission of senators, congressmen, and others, and I was one of the members of that commission, a public documents commission, for 2 years. Mm. They were concerned that a president like Nixon might burn tapes and other materials and not make them accessible to the public and to historians. And at one of the sessions, I asked, why didn't that same rule apply to the judiciary, also supported by taxpayers' money? And there were some jurists who thought that was a fine idea. I remember Judge Carl McGowan, an admirable figure, saying that any paper that I generated was paid for by the taxpayers of this country, and they've got a right to see it. But there were numbers of other judges who didn't feel that way at all. Uh-huh. Hugo Black, a great favorite of Ed's and admired by many historians, himself, although a great exponent of access to information and freedom of expression, burned all of his papers, burned the papers that dealt with his conference notes. When a biography was written of Harlan Fiske Stone, who did preserve his conference notes, Sherman Minton, another justice, burned all of his papers. Is virtually nothing left, and the court has always been very protective of mm-hmm. what goes on. So this is a problem for historians.
Another curious example of the way the lawyers or the judicial mindset what looks at history and the writing of history. Ed Yoder, syndicated columnist, and Bill Luchtenberg from the University of North Carolina. We have been talking about American legal history and interpreting the Constitution. Let's conclude our discussion. Should American citizens read the Constitution? What are they going to learn there? What kinds of questions should they ask of themselves about this document that is so central to our culture? Bill Luchtenberg, you want me to start with you?
Well, I think that they would probably find numbers of phrases that were puzzling to them, mm-hmm. like letters of marque and reprisal, and would wonder what that was about. And I would think that if they had an annotated copy of the Constitution, I think of a book like that by Corwin and Peltison that explains what these phrases mean and what the court and other institutions have made about them over time, they would find that a good deal more helpful. But sure, particularly as we approach the bicentennial season, it's not going to greatly hurt anybody to have read the Constitution at least once.
Ed Yoder?
Well, I certainly endorse what Bill says there. You know, there was a famous instance. I go back again to Hugo Black. There was a famous and a wonderful television interview done of Hugo Black in his late years on the court by Eric Severide and Martin Agronsky, then of both of CBS News. And in the course of that conversation, the justice withdrew from his pocket a very battered sort of standard copy of the U.S. Constitution issued in vast numbers by the government printing office, and he flourished it and showed how it was moth-eaten and well-thumbed and so forth. And CBS News on impulse said, we will give a copy of this standard issue government printing office constitution to everybody who's seen this program and writes in and wants one. They were so flooded with requests for the text of the Constitution of the United States that it ran the bill for the production of this program way up, notwithstanding that these things were very inexpensive, which indicates there's a certain appetite out there among the American public for information about the Constitution, if only it was stimulated, if only it was sort of brought to mind. I hope, indeed, as Bill says, during the bicentennial of the Constitution, that every American citizen would take it upon himself or herself to learn something about the text and history of the Constitution. There's some wonderful books. Charles Warren's History of the Supreme Court of the United States is a wonderful book. Anthony Lewis's book called Gideon's Trumpet is a marvelous book on the way the Constitution works. Joe Alsup's book, The 168 Days, about a field which Bill Luchtenberg is even now doing, what I'm sure will be also a wonderful book on the history of the court. There's so many things that could be mentioned. Beveridge's biography of Chief Justice Marshall, the works of Corwin, who has been mentioned. These things are accessible. They are very readable. They're not esoteric, and I think people would find them very interesting.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the Supreme Court and interpreting the American Constitution. My guests were William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Edwin Yoder, Jr., a syndicated columnist who writes for the Washington Post Writers Group. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, William Luchtenberg wrote In the Shadow of FDR, a history of the modern American presidency from Roosevelt to Reagan, published in 1983. Professor Luchtenberg is now at work on two forthcoming books about FDR and the Supreme Court crisis of 1937. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Interpreting the Constitution, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about poets and poetry. My guest will be Archie Ammons of Cornell University. Archie Ammons received the National Book Award for his collected poems in 1973, and the Bollingen Prize for Poetry in 1975. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about the Supreme Court and the American Constitution. Is the Constitution a living document or a changeless cultural touchstone? Some answers and insights from William Luchtenberg of the University of North Carolina and from Edwin Yoder, Jr., a syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Interpreting the Constitution. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.